From RunAsRadio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Wen announcing show 1000 with guest Paul Thurrott, recorded Sunday, August 31st, 2025. Run As Radio is produced each week by Sound Thoughts, LLC. For more information, visit SoundThoughtsLLC.com. You can follow us on X at x.com/runasradio.
Hi, this is Richard Campbell. Thanks for listening to Run As Radio. And here we are. It's episode 1000. I don't know how the heck this happened. I'm deeply disturbed by the whole situation. But the good news is I have my friend Paul with me to try and get me through the madness it is and ask me anything about Run As. Well,
I will do my best to be as sunny and positive as I usually am.
Yeah, I guess that's what we count on from you, Paul. Definitely, for sure.
It's like another milestone on the way to death.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, one step closer. All right, I will read a comment. This is from show 900, so a good, 100 shows ago. Totally relevant to you and I. Jay Michaud asked this question 2 years ago because I'm only recording one a week, so it's about 2 years ago. Hey, for sure, 1,000, you can have a funeral for, and then he struck that out, a celebration of the innovations of Windows 10 as it reaches the end of support.
Oh, boy.
Which I've responded to at the time. I would, but I suspect that Microsoft will extend primary support for Win 10 a bit longer, as they usually do with popular OS versions. Now, admittedly, 2 years ago, it was supposed to be April of 2025 that it was over. And then they extended it 6 months, right? It went down to October.
And then 3 more years or 1 year, depending on who you are, and we'll see.
And whether you buy cloud from them or whether you pay them some money or...
Yeah.
I know lots of sysadmins who are talking to the CFOs right now about we don't want to update these machines. We're not ready to replace all the hardware. We're going to pay another year. Like, it seems to be a pretty common practice.
Windows 10 is good, a little bad, right? I mean, it's one of two major Windows releases in my memory that it was universally welcomed upon its release because its predecessor was so reviled, and that's interesting.
For legitimate or non-legitimate reasons, but I mean, interesting. Sinofsky's the one who made 7 that made everybody happy, and then he followed it up with 8 that made everybody unhappy, but okay, and here we are at 10.
I appreciate that special brand of psychosis, but so I look, for me, Windows 10 was a return to desktop centricity, which I, really, really, really appreciated.
And then they try to do some crazy things with, like, Windows 10's been through a lot too.
Yep.
They try to, okay, we're not going to have a new version of Windows, but there's going to be this 4-digit number that keeps changing and affects everything.
Yeah.
They did hard things.
This is the same thing with people. It's with anything else, with.
Absolutely.
With more and more experience, your views maybe change, good, bad, indifferent, whatever. But maybe it wore out its welcome in some ways. I don't know. But Windows 11, didn't get off to a great start either. So I think there are still people out there who, at this point, this happens a lot with Windows,
Sure. I
don't know. The new version, it's like, I don't know. I'm kind of.
You and I have been holding out for 12 a lot for a few years now.
I talked a lot about something called Windows 12 that does not exist.
Yes.
at least yet, yes.
No, you've got a whole section on that.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Jay, thank you so much for your comment. And one of the very special episode 1000 Run As mugs is on its way to you. And if you'd like one of those, you would have had to have sent me a question for this show.
Nice.
So you're not getting there in episode 1000 if you're hearing this, but the bunch of folks who did will. I guess I'll better send you one too, Paul, so you can show it to Leo because he won't have one.
That will make him very sad.
All right, let's put that away and let's start at the top. I've got some recorded ones, just a few. Mostly folks just emailed me. Lead off with John Weiss's comment or question. How has the evolution of Windows operating systems or other Microsoft products made your work in producing or hosting Run As Radio shows easier? Have any aspects in the past 18 years of technological, sociological, or personal changes made it harder to do? And thanks for the quality content over the years. And here's to many more. I mean, the big one is cloud, right?
Yep.
Like that's been the biggest impact. And I remember, of course, doing .NET Rocks even longer ago. But in 2007, there was no cloud, really.
Right.
And the question of when to start using cloud for Carl and I, for DNR, and naturally as Run As Radio, took a while. We took our time with that. And in fact, we had a moment with Scott Guthrie where he looked at us and goes,
"Yep,
you guys are using Azure, right?" And I'm like, yeah. It's like, we kind of give you a bunch of free Azure. You'd think you'd use it. Actually, the biggest problem of making podcasts for this long is shaking off cruft.
Yes.
Right? We have a lot of old practices and old methods, and it's taken time to peel a lot away to use newer software and newer approaches and make things easier over time.
Well, it's also just a resistance to change when you feel like what you're doing works.
Yeah.
You know?
When I've also been blown away by how much Windows Weekly has changed, even just a little time I've hung around, but popping in on the show a few times. Like, that thing was produced like a major television effort when I first encountered it. And it's just, now it's Leo in his attic.
Right. It's astonishing because when he started Twitlio, you know, he did what TV stations were doing, but for far less money.
Yeah.
And then he's had to adapt yet again because the world has changed so much. You know, this museum's gone, but there was a wonderful museum in DC called the Newseum, which had all these incredible historical artifacts, you know, parts of the Twin Towers from 9/11, you know, the Unabomber's shack, you know, Daniel Pearl's ThinkPad laptop. It was an incredible place. But one of them was a giant TV production truck with the giant, you know, the crane on the top for the satellite connectivity so they could be on scene. And they said, this thing has been replaced by this. And it was just an iPhone.
Yeah, totally.
You know,
100% true.
And that's a great visual way to, you know, understand how that world has changed.
And it's cheating a little because it ignores the whole cellular network part of the problem and so forth. Yes. Like you offloaded to infrastructure. So, it's dramatically changed, man. And it's a heck of a lot more podcasts. You can tell it's gotten easier. There's no two ways about it. Back when we were starting, I think we were very lucky to be in technology because our audience was technical enough to figure out how to get the show, you know?
Yes. And I mean, back then it was very much an offline experience.
Yeah.
You would record, you would produce, you would publish somewhere. Mm-hmm. People would download it to a device, probably an iPod, you know, back in the day.
2002 for .NET Rocks, they were burning them as CDRs because that's what they had.
There you go. Yeah. Yep.
When we first started going on the road, going to conferences and things, people would bring us their favorite CDRs that they had burned and we'd sign them.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
That is amazing. Isn't that amazing? I love that.
Yeah. No, things have moved on. And when you predate the iPod, you're really in a situation, but you know, that's not what Run As was.
But, you know, just the nature of Run As, just the name, right? It tells you a lot about the show in the sense that, you know, this wouldn't have happened in the 1990s.
Nope.
You know, this is something that came up out of, you know, Microsoft having a big push into, businesses and enterprises, especially. And, you know, that was the big thing with the cloud. I mean, it's a very conservative kind of audience as far as upgrading goes.
Mm-hmm.
And now you've got stakeholders who are saying, well, hold on a second. You're telling me I'm going to get rid of my Exchange infrastructure and buy into this cloud and pay Microsoft. And what about my job? You know, how do I factor into all of this? Right. I mean, there's a lot of resistance, until there wasn't, I guess, you know, except for some regulatory and data sovereignty type issues. But I mean, for the most part, I think the world accepts this now as a thing.
You know? Yeah. All right. Let's move along. Mark Wansel, who's a longtime listener, lots of comments as well. He asks directly to you, Paul, in episode 647, Paul was the guest. This is July 2019. And I think we called the show, Does Windows Still Matter?
Right. I assume I just said no, and it was like 90 minutes of dead air. No.
I'm pretty sure it wasn't, actually.
No, I definitely wasn't. Windows is central to my life and career.
Yeah.
It's hard for me, even though things have changed, right? The phone obviously came along and that changed everything. And Windows still my focus, you know. I'm a writer and I need the big keyboard, the screen and all that. And I've used every platform there is to do every possible thing you could do for good, bad, or indifferent. And I still very much prefer Windows. And like I, there were warts and there were problems and there are good years and bad years and all that kind of stuff. But does Windows still matter? Which is sort of like asking, does the PC still matter? I mean, yes, despite the fact that does it matter to create like a native Windows app today? No, probably not for most companies or people. Is Windows the first go-to choice, for app developers, service developers, whatever? No, probably not. But as far as...
on the admin side...
I don't know what to call it. That first class...
This is the product we manage.
Yeah. It's still the most full-featured. It's still the most versatile. It's still the best choice... In that it's not narrow either. It's in some ways it feels narrow, but that kind of traditional productivity workflow thing, Word, Excel, PowerPoint, OneNote, Exchange, Outlook, et cetera. We're talking about over a billion people there, right? I mean, yeah. This is, it's still the best platform for that. And that matters very much. So yes, I think it does still matter. I know the world's gotten bigger. That's the thing.
Sure.
Right. It's not so much that Windows was diminished, although, from an emphasis perspective, yes. We do so much more now digitally on devices in the cloud now with AI, et cetera. So Windows is now just a big piece of the puzzle, but yes, I would say it matters.
And a smaller piece than it used to be. It used to be almost all the puzzle, but then the problem space got way larger and Windows didn't fill it all.
The way to, to conceptualize that in some ways is just to consider what Microsoft has become. Microsoft was the Windows company. Microsoft did expand beyond Windows pretty quickly, by the way, right? Office obviously predates Windows in some ways, at least from a popularity standpoint. And then into work groups and companies and enterprises and server and then the cloud, et cetera, like we said. But as Windows becomes a smaller piece of that pie, as Microsoft is no longer the only dominant company in personal technology, those two things are today bigger than ever in some ways still, right? Even though it's just that the pie has gotten bigger.
Yeah, without a doubt. Let's take a question here from Dave Aykroyd, who's the current record holder for Run As Mugs. Yes, every time I read a comment from you on the show, I will send you a mug. They come in 11 colors, and Dave's up to 6.
Nice.
So nobody's gotten them all, but I have to check with him. It's like, what color do you need now? And I read one of his comments. Dave says, congratulations on reaching 1,000 shows. My question is around Windows Server 2025 and ARM. There seems to be an endless preview phase of WS25 on ARM on Azure and no sign of it coming out of preview or heading for other cloud providers. I think there should be some advantages to running Windows services on ARM machines, but can you confirm my thinking is correct? I mean, cost should be cheaper due to lower power consumption.
Hmm.
And then the following roles could take advantage of the short instruction sets and work more efficiently than x86. Active Directory.
Wow.
SQL. Although he's afraid of what licensing might happen in that scenario. IIS. And then it follows up with, and on workstations, ARM and NPUs get lumped together as Copilot Plus PCs. Do we want the same for general purpose servers? Or is it something we want specific SKUs of server instances to have the choice of NPU or an options for TOPS? And thanks very much for your podcast, especially Run As. I don't know how my career would have progressed without the knowledge and general insights provided by the pods. Also, since this is a celebratory show, during the recording, I think it would be interesting if both you and Paul had a ball something nice open and played the AI shot game.
Wow.
No, not going to do that.
Yeah, can't do that. It's, it's the middle of the day as we record this.
It's Sunday morning, and it's the only time we can record. Mm. You're flying out tomorrow. Mm-hmm. I have a end of summer party tonight. I don't need to show up to that party loaded.
Oh, nice.
And goodness knows, looking through these questions we've got, there's a lot of AI.
Get in the car right after this, too, so I can be careful
here. Not a thing, no. So thanks, Dave, and congrats on getting the 1,000 mug, which is going to be completely unique. All right, dude, what do you think?
Well, let me start by asking you a question related to the last question, which is, does Windows Server still matter, right? In other words, what he's talking about very explicitly here is on-prem server, it seems like, which, has...
Well, he said 25 on ARM on Azure. Good, they...
On Azure, oh, okay.
But...
Yeah.
You make a great point. I mean, I think the main reason you're not seeing server on ARM in a big way is there's just not enough chips.
Right.
Right. Like they're nobody's building these machines at scale. The only place you can find a Windows for ARM chip right now is in a Copilot Plus PC laptop. Like, I'd kill to build a desktop like that.
Yeah, you know, one of the big conversations you and I had had over the past year was this notion of Copilot plus PC, Snapdragon explicitly moving past this laptop form factor.
Yeah.
And this past January, Microsoft or Snap or Qualcomm or someone announced the first kind of NUC class mini desktop PC, which, by the way, still has not arrived in the market. So, you know,
well, I've got that brain damaged dev kit one sitting here.
Yes, yeah, same. Right. Okay. Right. Right.
Which, by the way, does not qualify as a Copilot plus PC.
Actually, it does. By does the way. It? It does. Yeah. Oh,
okay.
Yeah, I've got it right here. I'm not using it for the show, but my goal is to get this to be the podcast machine.
That's cool.
Yeah. But so, yes, I mean, what he's asking basically is, well, one of the things he's asking is whether or not, first, would this be cheaper due to lower power usage? Especially in an Azure context, I would say yes, for sure.
Yeah, probably, eventually.
Yes.
The problem is that Microsoft's going to build these chips themselves, so I'm saying they're going to recoup that money for as long as they possibly can. And
that's right.
Considering the recent conversations I've had about TSMC load times, like, actually making a new chip with TSMC is a multi-year process. Like, it's just that easy to do, much less that they can get enough time to produce a scale.
Exactly. You're competing with Apple and whomever else that
are every mobile chipset,
already locking in. Yep, yep. But yeah, I part of it might be the basic compatibility stuff too that we've seen on the client side, where particular services or servers that run on top of this thing may need to be adapted to run natively on ARM, which would make it even more efficient, obviously, and better. So that's going to be an issue.
Well, and that would all be internal Windows development or internal Microsoft development. Although you're also looking at a list of products that are primarily in maintenance. So it's also, who do you get to work on that?
Yeah, that's right. Right. How much? Even if we are going to do this, is it going to get past a simple recompile, basic benchmarking to make sure it works? Oh. It's hard to say.
It's a lot of Windows not written in .NET, let me tell you.
Yeah. So if we accept the fact that Azure itself and Windows Server share an architecture, so to speak, and have a common background, there's no doubt that Azure itself and then just cloud computing in general, data centers are going ARM for all those reasons, right? For all the right reasons. So, I mean, part of this is going to be one of those things where we're going to wake up one day and Microsoft will announce, hey, by the way, X percent of our servers are just ARM. It's working great. We've saved X number of dollars this year, whatever it is. So,
you'll find out about it as a quarterly report. They're not going to make it.
Yeah.
I don't know if they're even going to sell it.
No, right.
We're
just doing it. It saved us money. We're passing the savings along to you, perhaps. Probably not.
Maybe.
Something along those lines.
The shape of workload thing is really interesting, long instruction set versus short instruction set, because it's not obvious as to what will benefit. You know where long instruction sets really shine? Working with large chunks of memory. Like, I think SQL runs better on Intel even than AMD because Intel had longer instructions. Mm-hmm. The AMD machines needed more cores to have comparable workloads on SQL Server.
Yep.
And because the licensing was by core, AMD had no chance running SQL Server. It ended up being all Intel. So, you'd almost argue that's true for web stuff sometimes. Like, you shouldn't move big strings of data, but people do.
Sure.
So, yeah.
Well, there's a lot of non-optimized JavaScript code out there that is going to require all kinds of processing just to do simple things like figuring out data types and so forth. So, yeah, this is very interesting.
If I was in Microsoft's shoes, I'd be building those ARM chips to put into machines that you control directly to save you money.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Until you have so many of them that you can now start making them into a set of VMs. And as far as the GPU-CPU mix, I think they keep adding new options on that all the time. I wouldn't be surprised if there's sort of a base AI-friendly VM that's got like 100 TOPS in it.
Like a hardware-accelerated VM of some sort.
As opposed to the HPC machines where you're harnessing these really big expensive GPUs. And by the way, those are expensive VMs. But that's for supercomputing workloads, not for, hey, there's LLM stuff. There's neural net stuff threaded through all this code. So I occasionally need some kind of NPU.
Yeah, I think that is how Windows Server on ARM is distributed, right? It's a VHD,
like a Hyper-V.
VX. Yeah. There, yeah, the Hyper-V virtual machine. Yeah.
But they can make new ones all the time, right? That's not hard to do. How they're going to harness this stuff together is going to be really interesting. Also, I think the shape of server workloads, like, I don't think you're going to be running a lot of LLMs in those contexts. Or if you are, you're going to do it with front-end machines. So, or you're going to do it as a separated workload on a high performance machine. Like, you'd be better off with one high end neural net capable machine VM surrounded by a bunch of nons that it's passing those workloads back and forth to.
So, I mean, just the nature of Windows Server in Azure in general is basically a way to move a legacy on-prem workload to the cloud, save money, right?
Yeah.
Because you can't move off of it for whatever reason, but it's not the center of your infrastructure. You still need it running, right?
Yeah.
So, I don't know. What role does ARM play for those guys? I mean, it's kind of hard to say.
Yeah, I don't think much of one, really.
Yeah.
Because in the end, Microsoft doesn't want to sell you virtual machines anyway. It sells it to just to get a workload to you.
That's right.
It wants you to go up in the platform. So these new architectures, they're likely to be platform-only architectures just because why?
Mm-hmm.
You don't have legacy workloads in this configuration, or at least not yet.
Right.
Longer it takes for us to get this figured out.
If this thing works out great, we are going to have those workloads, but not yet.
Exactly. True.
In a best-case scenario. Yeah.
All right. Let's take this question from Dwight Thibodeau. I'll go with Thibodeau. I always listen to both of you every week on Windows Weekly, and I really enjoy listening and learning from both of you. In the context of the rapid evolution of cloud technologies and increasing adoption of hybrid work environments, what are the most pressing challenges IT professionals face when integrating M365 and Azure services into their existing infrastructure? And what best practices can be implemented to ensure seamless collaboration, security, and compliance across diverse teams? I think you pretty much answered your question there, Dwight. The killer is security by a mile. Most people are still, and when they're on-prem, they're still running perimeter security. They've not really gone in depth, and that just doesn't fly with cloud. You've got cloud is zero trust by nature, and people have a tough time retrofitting those two things together. They don't get along. And so you're basically forced down this path of maturing the security infrastructure on-prem to be able to play with cloud or just have these serious vulnerabilities that, you know, trip a lot of big red flags.
Yeah. We're entering an interesting era here for those of us who've been around a while, you know, comparable to the early 2000s with the trustworthy computing stuff. Today it's, you know, secure future initiative or whatever,
yeah.
And Windows Resiliency Initiative, et cetera. CrowdStrike, thank you so much for that. So
get out of my ring zero.
Yeah. So things are changing, right? And this is, you know, 20 years ago, we were talking about what became Windows Server 2003 as it's a server, not a surfboard, meaning they've defanged IE at that time in the server because you're not supposed to be sitting there using it interactively. But today, we have these threats just across the stack.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we need something a little more pervasive, I guess.
Yeah. And it's not college kids with a propagator worm, right?
Mm-mm.
It's black. Mm-hmm. It's offshore black hats who are getting paid in Bitcoin to lie to you about recovering your data. And then and then your recovery is no faster or slower than if you just refused it. So, it's the situation is far more serious. And I got to tell them, like, Microsoft's fast track, like their onboarding strategies and so forth, they're pretty good. But most people have a tough time using them. Like, they're still not easy.
Yeah.
There's a whole lot of questions you have to answer up front that most people can't answer, not easily. Like, it goes back up to business and so forth. And you really, this idea of, hey, we're going to migrate to the cloud in a few months. And it's actually, first, we need a few months to organize ourselves sufficiently to even begin the migration. And your typical champion for that migration can't wait that long. So you end up, because you're rushing to show workloads in the cloud, making serious mistakes.
Yeah.
And, you know, literally the show before this one, 999, is common Azure mistakes that we make, right? And it's about not using the landing pad capabilities, not correctly configuring tenant ownership, like all of those things.
There's a million ways you can make
so many steps.
Back in the day, we would have best practices, as he uses this term in the question, and you would get a checklist in the admin console for server and do this. You know, today it's a little more proactive. It's a little more, we can do the work for you. AI will probably help with this at some point, I suppose. But yeah, the word hybrid is what sticks out here to me, because this is the central benefit of Microsoft's kind of infrastructure transition capabilities for customers, but also introduces complexity and difficulty. And, you know, it's nice that you can have different groups of users, different groups of workloads. They all have different configurations, et cetera, but those things also have to interact. And I think it's those interaction points that in some ways are often the, you know, the Achilles heel or whatever of this scenario from a security perspective. So, yeah.
And it's really tough to observe that. Like, some of the new tooling coming around conditional access has made this less painful. You can actually see what privileges are being used, where they came from. Like, that used to be super tough to see. But often you looked at it a year ago, you went with what you had, and you haven't come back to see how they've improved it.
Yes.
Because if you try and read those update logs that they spit out, they're impenetrable and they're infinite.
Yes, they are. And they're right. They're growing as you look at them. So there's probably a kind of a wellspring of negativity around AI in some ways, but I have to say these issues are where AI will help. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean it's always going to be right and correct and all this stuff, but
no,
this, what you're talking about, which is essentially the difference between reactive and proactive being impossible because of the scope and scale and whatever of these infrastructures, and the complexity, that's why these kind of AI insights, I hate to use these words, but I think can help people a lot.
And to be honest, for folks who are listening, it's like the back half of the show is going to be the AI stuff. I've done my best to hold it off.
Yeah.
But I just sorted the questions because there's half of the questions.
Right, yeah. I don't mean to jump ahead, but you know, when you think about.
No, you're right in the right groove, dude, I think.
Yeah. You have, well, you this is complex stuff. Mm. And it's. You want to be careful. I don't think, well, we will see this, but it's not so much I'm looking for a green button, like fix it.
No.
You know, make it right. But it's the same thing when you're using AI for coding or whatever. You want it to show you what it's doing. You want it to explain to you why it's correct.
Yeah.
You want to be able to test it before it goes live.
Yeah.
And I think I do think that will help.
Yeah. We are buried under complexity and constantly changing things. And these tools seem to have some advantage to help us sort that through. All right, let's do our first audio clip, and then we'll take a break. So here, this one's from Alexander Nielsen, but I think he'll introduce himself.
Hi, Richard and Paul. I was wondering, what do you think is the most significant blind spot or otherwise unaddressed situation for the industry or practitioners?
All right, Alexander. I thought about this a long time because we're dealing with security issues, but they're very front and we're battling AI. I think we're getting better at, in general, understanding what's going on in our systems from an attacker's perspective and a licensing perspective, so forth. I think the blind spot is the diversity of users and what they actually use that our companies provide for them. And the fact that a lot of them use the tools their own way, relatively inefficiently, and many tools are going unused. Mm-hmm. And for better or worse, there's not been a lot of, you know, it's one thing to manage logging for how much data are we collecting, how full are these drives, who's attacking us from the other side. It's another thing to get into utilization, like who is writing good emails, who is using Teams, like what are those products, and how can we help them be better? And then it's this double whammy of, as soon as you start pushing on those aspects, like back when I did real work, which goodness knows was a long time ago, I was very big on when we put out new versions of the major apps inside of the organization, I would watch the logs very closely to see who was using them. And mostly I was watching to make sure we weren't about to tip over because it was something we didn't account for and we're running out of resources. But then I'd also see there were whole groups of users that weren't using it. And when I went to them and said, hey, you know, we have this new feature and you're not using it, they're like, are you spying on me? Like, there's a very difficult threshold as a sysadmin between being the creepy guy who sees everything and actually making sure that people are getting the value of the infrastructure we built for them.
Wow. That sounds like Microsoft's excuse for telemetry. Mm.
This is the whole Viva line of tools, right?
Yeah, like, exactly. Right. Yeah.
This is
state-sponsored surveillance,
Well, it's, you know, what they're trying to do with that, and I've had these conversations a bunch of times, is how do you get the person out of the loop to decide who to speak to, right? Because the other thing that would happen, and it certainly happened with me, is it tended to be a certain group of people who were really struggling with tools, you know, talking to the mouse, and then they felt discriminated against. Like, why are you always talking to me? Because everybody else uses this tool, dude. Like, I just don't know why you don't.
You're still sending faxes, Bob. That's why.
That's why, yeah. And I do appreciate, you know, tools, you know, also meet the people where they work. But this, the Viva tools are about, you set up policy about utilization. So it's just the software that's prompting folks. I just think it's too abstract for most people to use.
Yep. Yeah. There's also kind of a license compliance component to that, which I think feels a little, you know, to people, but
be the administrator during a sexual harassment within a company.
Yeah.
That was done over corporate email.
Right. Fantastic.
Because no, it is not easy for me as an administrator to read your email, but I can do it if I must. It's pain in the butt.
Right.
And suddenly we're in this criminal situation where the company is exposed and, you know, those tools get rolled out and it is creepy and horrible.
Yep.
And, you know, and it very much for me, it's like, do not write anything in an email that you're not prepared to stand in front of a judge and talk about at any time, because that's the reality, right? Once it's been written, it's in their world forever, and it could come back to haunt you. It's unavoidable. But to, you know, the blind spot thing, like we're addressing a lot of issues, but utilization issues, I think they're tertiary. They're so far down the list of problems, even with all the new automation we have. That I think it's the still ignored space in our workspace.
Yeah.
And you talk about, I'm hoping these new tools will give us more time to do that so that we help more people be more productive.
Yeah. This has come up with you over the past year a couple of times. And when you talk to people like Tony Redmond too, you know, this notion that your organization is paying for these tools and you're using some tiny, you don't even know some of them exist.
Yeah.
You know, let alone use them to any degree. It's definitely a problem.
Yeah. And then you also got that sort of, don't tell me how to do my work. I'm my expert in my career, in my role, right?
Like, yeah. So that ties into what I was thinking, which is, I don't know how to describe this quickly, but I guess I would call it a complacency issue. Mm-hmm. I alluded to this earlier, but this notion that, you know, when the cloud was coming in, it's like, you mean to tell me my last act as Exchange administrator is going to be to hand over the reins to Microsoft? And it's like, yeah, that is what's happening. But, you know, you got complacent, you know, you got into this industry, which is dynamic and fast moving and always changing, and you settle in. You did, we migrated to every other Exchange version for two or three cycles. Mm-hmm. And now we're migrating to the cloud. And you're like, whoa, hold on a second. I've been doing this. And it's like, yeah, but you forgot how to do these other things. You forgot to keep learning. You forgot to look out for the best interests of your company, your employer, right, rather than your personal best interest. Because your personal best interest is don't ever evolve, don't change, and hope no one notices you.
Yeah.
You know, just keep doing the same thing over and over again, right?
Well, and no organization has no Exchange administrators. It's just that the scope of their job is much narrower now. I mean, they're not responsible for drive allocations and distributed servers and things like that.
Yeah.
They are responsible for policy around these things. Like,
yeah, this is another AI conversation, not to keep injecting that early on here, but people are, you know, freaking out right now over losing jobs over AI. And a lot of the narrative there is, you know, these jobs are still going to exist by and large, a lot of them.
Yeah.
The nature of them is going to change. We might need fewer people doing it maybe, or but the responsibility you have or your day-to-day workflow, whatever might change, right?
Yeah.
Because of this. So like the move to the cloud didn't end. We still have email.
No.
We still have databases. We still have whatever.
There's very few people spinning screwdrivers anymore, racking and stacking servers.
Yep.
Like if that was what you loved being an administrator, boy. Yeah, you're disappointed. Because that's been gone for a while.
Yep.
And you know, part of this is, one of the things that happens when this toil work, this routine work gets automated is really your job more and more is working on the preventative side.
Which is the proactive reactive thing where this is arguably what you wanted all along, which was not to wake up or to get woken up in the middle of the night by the latest problem. Mm. And then completely resetting whatever you thought it was you were doing that week to do something completely different. It's to be able to, have things work well enough that you can say, okay, how can we make life better?
Yeah. And what are we missing? Whoever. Like, are we looking in the holes, being ahead of problems? Like,
it's what we thought we wanted.
Yeah. I do have met lots of folks, too, that have been in the industry for a long time that are addicted to the pounding surf.
I know.
Like, you know the great thing about a crisis is you know what to do. Right. Yeah. Like you're just
plus
on
you're,
it.
Plus you're needed.
Yeah, right? You're needed. I mean, you're wanted. You're celebrated. You're in the hammering. It is addictive because preventative work is one of those things where if you do your job perfectly, nobody can tell. It's totally invisible.
It's thankless.
You know, and men's always have this problem. It's super. You can get a C or you can get an F. You can't get anything else.
Yep. Well, I mean, look, anyone who's worked in customer service in their lives ever, you know, including when you were a kid in a fast food restaurant or whatever, knows not a lot of positive feedback. You know, you don't get a lot of people walking up to the counter saying, you know, that meal was great. You served it really quickly and efficiently. I really appreciate you. Thank you for being here as a human being. It's like, no, but if the pickle's missing, you're going to hear from that guy.
All over it. Yeah. You know? Yeah, it's a lot of negative.
He'll throw it at you from his seat, right?
All right. Let's do the break the fun way. I'll give it to Mark Wansel.
Hello, Richard and Paul. This is Mark Wansel from Detroit, Michigan. I think we need to interrupt here for a very important message.
This episode of Run As Radio is brought to you by the Next Gen AI Conference, which will be held at the Lowe's Sapphire Falls Resort in Orlando, Florida from October 7th and 9th, 2025. Next Gen AI is a premier event dedicated to advancing generative AI development on Microsoft Azure. Expect to dig deep into the world of agentic AI. The conference covers a wide variety of AI topics, including implementing and tuning powerful multimodal agents with Azure AI Foundry and AI Agent Service, exploring the range of the latest large language models available from the model catalog and using the model inference service, and leveraging the latest platform features and frameworks for orchestration, routing, and tool use. At the NextGen AI Conference, you can expect keynotes and sessions from Microsoft engineers and leaders, and in-depth sessions and workshops from industry experts helping you get the most from this new wave of AI technologies. Listeners to Run As Radio can get a discount on registration by using the code RUNAS at azureaiconf.com. The NextGen AI Conference is October 7th and 9th, 2025, at the Lowe's Sapphire Falls Resort in Orlando. Register today at azureaiconf.com. Thanks, Mark, and thanks for your many questions over the years and your routine listenership. We're going to hear from him again. We gave him one at the top, one in the middle, and one at the end because he had a lot to ask about. And with that, you're listening to Run As Radio. It's episode 1000 here with my friend Paul Thurrott. And here we go with the AI back half.
Yeah.
Daniel asks, I'm a traditional IT sysadmin doing everything from end user deployment, server and virtualization deployment, looking after our network infrastructure, and of course, the whole M365 suite. We keep having wave after wave of redundancies, both in IT and other parts of our company, with one of the reasons being, quote, efficiency due to AI. So with the surge of AI in the IT space, what would be your advice to ensure that I can continue to progress in my career? First, stay ahead of the curve and use AI to my benefit. Or secondly, ensure that whatever I move to isn't replaced by AI again in a few years.
Yikes.
I'm glad that you phrased this way, Daniel, that efficiency is due to AI, because it's just reminding it that AI doesn't lay people off. People lay people off. And they've been using excuses to lay people off that they could find for the longest time. And they're usually wrong and false. And if anyone's dumb enough to be laying off people due to AI right now, and they're actually doing that, which I don't think they are, this product's not mature enough yet. Like, are you crazy? You can't bet a workload on this. But there are many other forces acting out in the industry right now. And this is a convenient one to use. And so they are using it without a doubt. I don't know that you're going to protect yourself from getting good with AI, but don't do it for that reason. You do it because being more productive makes you more valuable and certainly easier to employ. I mean, at this moment, if you are looking for work, you better have AI on your LinkedIn. Like,
right.
Because that is unfairly a popular hiring element right now. Mm-hmm. But the main thing they're going to ask you when you show up to that job is, so how do we use this thing? Because again, I just don't have a sense that people are being wildly successful with it, except in a very few narrow sets of areas.
Yeah, this is like that office space scene with the Bobs, you know?
Yeah.
What is it exactly that you do here? It's like, I interact with the AI. Yeah. Okay. Is there some reason the users couldn't just do that? Yeah. So there's no real way to ensure
that I have AI skills. Next,
yeah. Well, in other words, you move into, maybe you weren't that exchange guy. You know, you saw the future was going to change. You were learning. And as that happened, you helped your company make that transition and you found yourself a slightly different job. Mm-hmm. Doing something else. So, I mean, part of it ensuring that the specific role you choose now is never going to be replaced by AI or however you want to say that is kind of difficult. But just, I think, continually learning and evolving is key. I mean, just in general, for starters.
Sure. And no given role is completely replaced by AI. Like, that's not a thing.
Right, which is why I had a hard time even saying that. Yeah. I mean, it's like, all of us will. AI is a problem because AI. There's no thing that is AI.
Because science fiction has made us all crazy about it.
Yeah, this is like saying Microsoft is adding 100 new features to Microsoft 365 every month. How do I ensure that my job isn't replaced by one of those features? It's like, right. Well, if your job could be replaced by one of these features, you might not have that good of a job. Sure. For starters, but. Yeah.
Well, and even, you know, before the break, we were talking about the exchange guy, like the guy who specialized in organizing storage for exchange. And that's the only thing he was doing because that's how big their operation was. Yeah. If that guy wasn't willing to change, we don't need that anymore.
That's right. That's right.
There's still one exchange person, but it turned out to be the exchange generalist that could do all the little things.
Which is fascinating. Yeah.
Isn't that? Yeah.
You have to kind of high level stuff like this. So, I mean, to me, AI is about saving time. And so part of it, this part of the skill set that we need to develop collectively is understanding the best places we can use AI to save time. Yeah. And best means a lot of different things, right? The most reliable, the most accurate, the most beneficial time-wise, perhaps, or whatever it is, or, you know, removing kind of rote work that is the type of thing where, you know, we talk about hallucinations, but if you as a human being are doing a lot of rote work, you stop paying attention and you make mistakes, you know?
Sure.
And so eliminating that from the equation is good. And we keep coming back to the same themes here. It's kind of interestingly gets you more into a proactive mindset. So it's like, well, you save some time. Now, what are you going to do with that time?
Yeah. How are you going to make it more valuable for the organization? And again, I think we are in this trap where, again, if we nail this and we keep making progress on this, like we nailed Y2K to the point where I'm now talking to kids who just believe Y2K wasn't a threat.
Yes, yes.
You know, it's like, dude, I bought a house off what I made fixing Y2K problems.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
As we get driven in the, you know, thinking bigger picture, as you get driven more and more of the preventative role, more and more you're going to have this question of, so what is it you do here? It's like, I stop this place from burning down every day.
Right.
So well, you don't even know there was ever a fire.
We all, the disasters stand out in everyone's brain.
Yeah.
We all remember them. What we don't remember is when the guy said, hey, if we don't fix this, we're going to have a huge problem. And we fixed it and nothing happened.
Yeah.
And life went on and everyone's like, well, what does this guy do? It's like, well, he saved our lives. That's what he did.
Yeah.
You know, that's what he does. He's saving our lives.
Do I have to let the server catch fire? A few folks to remember that I made sure the server didn't catch fire.
Yeah. Nothing?
I used that joke on a stage ages ago. It's like I was really good at my job, so nobody ever called me. So I turn a server off. Yeah, phone rings every time.
Yep. Like, and I was laid off. They had no idea what I was doing.
Yeah. Now they really miss me, but I still don't have a job. All right. Kevin Beaver's question. Reflecting on the incredible advancements in the IT world, what do you think has been one of the most significant technological hardware and or software innovations to truly define the IT trajectory more than anything else? What is something we are doing today you could never have fathomed or imagined 20 years ago? 2005. Yeah, managing an Azure tenant. Are you kidding? Yeah. You couldn't have envisioned the cloud.
When Microsoft announced what was at that time called Windows Azure,
right,
at whatever Tech Ed, I'm sure it was at, or whatever.
It was a PDC. Yeah.
PDC, okay.
Ray Ozzie on stage.
Ray Ozzie, who I miss desperately, but
such a lovely guy, but I didn't.
Genius and nice and whatever. But yeah, he.
And you remember that time he talked about all of the Microsoft properties that each had their own sets of racks. And he's like, this is stupid.
Yep.
We just want to have one set of racks and share the workload.
Look, I hope it's obvious as I've gone through these sort of vague examples over the years of things that I've encountered that I fall into that boat myself, right? Because when I was introduced to Windows Azure after the event, we were walking back to the press room and the PR people from Microsoft said, hey, we're doing a session for the press. I'm going to go into more details. If you have any questions, you might want to. I'm like, I have nothing but questions. I absolutely want to do this. Spend an hour in that room, ask questions, listen to questions, answers, whatever, walked out. And they said, how was it? I said, it was great. And they said, do you feel like you understand it better now? I said, no, I don't understand this at all. I didn't understand where the world was going.
Yeah. It's so overwhelming. I mean, isn't, if you've been doing this, I mean, the thing, yep. Cloud is 15 years old now or so.
Yeah.
And we're starting to get a handle on it.
That's right.
But it's taken this long. And it's like, I laugh that we think the AI is going to change everything. It's like ChatGPT was November of 22. We know nothing. Nothing.
Well, it's like cloud computing is never going to make any sense. You have to be online for it to work. It's like, right.
Yeah.
but we're all going to be online all the time, right? We just accept that that's going to be a thing.
That was the old Esther Dyson line. It was easier to put internet everywhere to make a good offline client.
We had to explain to our children recently that there was when we were growing up, that the TV would just turn off. It would just go away.
It would stop.
In the United States, they would play, maybe midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning, whatever time, depending on where you were, the show would end and they would play the national anthem. They'd play some patriotic imagery and the TV would go to static, yeah. Right? Snow. That was it. And this was confusing to them. Like, what do you mean? What? It wasn't just, it was on all the time. Right. And so I think when cloud computing was starting, a lot of people were still not on very good broadband or in broadband at all or whatever. And infrastructure wasn't there. And so it was a little bit confusing. It happened. These things take time, but, pervasive connectivity itself, right? This is in some ways the big deal. I think to keep bringing it back to AI for some reason, which was not my intent going into this, for whatever it's worth.
Why are you the AI advocate? How did this happen?
AI, he is potentially the missing piece of the puzzle in the sense that we have all of the world's data available to us, right? And we have this instant connectivity, ask a question, get an answer, et cetera. But making sense of that mess, because it's so much and so contradictory, depending on what it is you're looking for, I think that might be the value there, if they can ever figure out the accuracy stuff, right?
Well, this is the thing. It's like these neural nets, they are lossy compression models. You are JPEGing data.
That's amazing.
When you run it through a generative AI.
Right.
And hopefully it didn't lose the important bits. You don't really know.
I had a friend who worked at Microsoft at the time. This is easily 20 plus years ago, but he was telling me that, you bring up a photo and whatever editor Microsoft had at the time and you save it. You make a change and you save it. So you just lost a little bit of quality because it's JPEG. It's lossy, right? So then you save it again. You lose a bit. And I said, "What is this? Is like dementia. What are you talking about?" He says, "Yeah, I mean, eventually, if you edit it enough, you're going to just have a white image that will be nothing." Yeah. And I'm like, "I don't like the sound of this."
I built a tool like that where we save the same file repeatedly 10,000 times, mm-hmm. and it just pixelates out.
It's like the telephone game, right? By the time you get to the end of the chain, the guy at the bend at the end of it is spewing nonsense. It has nothing to do with the original message.
Which also speaks to the absurdity of the emergent superintelligence science fiction trope that is grabbing the AI hype cycle right now. It's like, this is degenerative data. You're going to get smarter by looking at a photocopy of a photocopy. You sure? You sure it's going to work like that?
I just love how much science fiction has impacted our understanding or our misunderstanding of AI. It's astonishing.
Yeah. It's a terrible name. Terrible name.
Yep.
Because it completely confuses everybody.
Yeah.
Right. It's hurt the whole thing. All right. Another audio clip. This one's from Michael Crook.
Hey, Richard. Congratulations on reaching 1,000 episodes. I was wondering, what has been the biggest innovation in the industry since you started recording this podcast?
Yeah, I hate to keep going back to it. Yeah.
It's .NET. It's .NET, isn't it?
.NET.
Yeah. Say it's .NET.
No, it was 2007 when I started. So the innovation wasn't Vista because that's when I started.
Yikes. Good timing, man.
Yeah.
Timing.
What do you know? It's like, I was just angry at the IT shows that existed at the time. They were so anti-Microsoft. I'm like, we all have this stuff. I know we're pissed at it, but we all have it. Why shouldn't we talk about it to some degree? Mm-hmm. I mean, I hate to just keep going back to that same thing. The cloud has changed everything. And the only reason we know that is it's been 15 years and we've had enough time to go, oh, wait, I wouldn't do this without the cloud now. It makes no sense to go the other direction. And the later technologies that come along, like AI, are just not, they don't own us that way yet. And I don't know if they will.
Yeah. I feel I just mentioned, you know, the first time I was confronted by this thing, Azure, and I didn't understand what was happening and how I, you know, that whole day was terrible for me. But, you know, every once in a while, someone will come up with a simple explanation. You're like, oh, okay, I can see that. You know, this notion of you need extra capacity over the holidays because you're a realtor.
A retailer.
What am I saying? Yeah. A retailer. Thank you.
Prepping for Black Friday, you know, classic.
Yeah. And you're like, okay, that's cool. Because otherwise you're paying for that infrastructure all the time. Mm-hmm. It's non-utilized really most of it. And then you get that one busy time of year and you're like, okay, that I get. Like, I get that.
No, when nice. And we used the to build to for fire peak, it up. Right? Like I spent so much money building infrastructure out for peak.
Yep. Yeah. So yeah, I think I would say absolutely cloud computing. The interesting thing is going to be, if flash forward, I don't know if we have to go 1,000 episodes more, but maybe 500 episodes or something. Will AI
be as impactful,
become that thing? Or is it really just, is it really AI plus cloud, right? That AI by itself would be a non-starter if it wasn't for that back end.
Well, but, and we always stand on the shoulders of giants. Obviously, AI wouldn't exist without cloud, but cloud wouldn't exist without internet, right? Yep. And virtualization, right?
Yes.
I remember when we were still pre-cloud, as the virtualization wave hit in like 2003, 2004, like we were emptying racks because we were using machines 100% and we were running out of power. Like as I emptied that rack, I was consuming the same number of watts, more or less, just doing it. You know, my number of racks I needed to consume those many watts was lower and the data center didn't have more. Right. Like we ran into this problem. It was like, I've now emptied this rack. I want to load it with new stuff. And he's like, sorry, we don't have any electricity for it.
Because
all your machines are running at 100%.
That's incredible.
Yeah. Which, geez, sounds just like the argument they're having right now over the AI workloads. Like, we learned to densify and it came with consequences. And the cloud was the better way to densify because we got that elasticity effect because they actually architected it better. Like, I think in general, all of our infrastructure is running better because of cloud rules. Whether you, even if you're working on-prem,
yes,
the cloud approach to organizing infrastructure is a better approach.
That's right.
And so we tend to reflect that now.
Well, yeah, it also better matches the distributed nature of these large companies, and especially if they're span geographies, which a lot of them do. And you have that kind of redundancy aspect, which was the central tenet of the internet to begin with, right? This notion that this thing was going to survive.
And it's always a chicken and egg thing. We're more distributed as companies because we can be, because this infrastructure allows it.
Look, if you had told me in 2002, three, whatever, and I'm trying to get a think timing wise, I believe this was before we knew anything about, say, like Viridian, which became Hyper-V, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
This notion that a virtual machine could somehow replace a physical server seemed ludicrous to me.
Oh, yeah.
Would have seemed ludicrous to me. The fact that that thing could then run in the cloud and also be better than a physical machine somewhere attached to a wire.
Oh, yeah.
This is a hard concept to get.
But you know what? I should curate this out of the Run-As episodes because I have the story of Hyper-V in Run-As because it only comes out around 2008. Talking about it from the beginning. And so it was like, oh, it makes sense for these web workloads, but it'll never run on for SQL Server. That makes no sense. It can't run Exchange, you know, bit by bit.
This is like the conversation we had right up top about how the way a version of Windows is perceived when it comes out versus when it's on the way out. Now people don't want to get rid of it. They love it. And is very, you know, Hyper-V or virtualization is like this, right?
Yep.
Where with this latest version of Windows Server, there's been a resurgence. Well, A, in server itself, right, which is excellent, but also a resurgence in the attention given to Hyper-V specifically. And that's fascinating to me. Because there was so much resistance to this. And now it's like, oh, no, we need more Hyper-V. We need better Hyper-V. And Microsoft's like, we're doing it. And we're like, yay. You know, like this is, you know, universally well met, right? I think, at least from what I've seen.
Yeah.
Like, nice. We like to see you paying attention to this.
Yeah, you're in a different place. But again, it takes longer than you think.
Yeah. Yes.
You know, we like to think we're moving faster. And maybe we are a little bit, but mostly no. You know, companies need more certainty than this. They need more reliability than this. And people change only so fast.
Well,
so we're always up against it.
That might be the best explanation of the problem of AI I've ever heard, by the way.
Yeah,
because that's exactly the
problem. I just got to keep remembering people. It's been 2.5 years.
That's the thing. Even though it feels like it's been 10, right? This has been a dense, compact couple of years.
Well, and there's a group of people highly incented to make it look as fast moving as possible. It's good for them, not good for anyone else. You know, and a lot of it's artificial.
It's terrible for me and for you, I would imagine. You know, if you cover this industry to any degree,
yeah,
just keeping track of this is a nightmare.
Oh,
as a customer, having to implement it or deal with it or manage it or whatever.
No, and
it just changes every day.
There's a reason that sysadmins are skeptical as they are, because you're usually right and occasionally pleasantly surprised, right? Like,
yeah, yes, yes. Yes. That thing I hate the most is now happening 10 times as fast. What's happening in my world? You know,
apparently, I always ask that question. It's like, is this technology amplifying our intelligence or amplifying our stupidity? Because I'm pretty sure it's the latter.
It's amplifying my blood pressure is what it's doing. For sure. You know.
All right. A couple more to go and we'll call this a show.
Okay.
Casper Larson, who gave me a lovely bottle of whiskey not that long ago when I was in Denmark, he said, which major new changes in required capabilities for IT pros have you seen coming since episode 1 and which one surprised you the most? In which ways have our own capabilities changed since episode 1 and which were by your own choice and which were to some extent forced on you? And which role do you see challenged most by AI, devs or IT pros? I mean, I keep falling back on the cloud thing over and over again, because that was something that I think nobody predicted. I do think, you know, our area, you know, you think in 2007, 2008, when I was first making this show, we were using virtualization primarily for test labs. Because resetting machines, right? I was constantly trying to figure out driver deployments, and it's like, try rolling it this way. Okay, machine mangled. Go back.
You almost have to kind of think back here, because Windows Server 2008 originally shipped without Hyper-V. Remember, it wasn't quite ready.
Yeah,
and they eventually introduced that. This was until very recently a standalone Hyper-V server as well. But very much the focus on this was. It was really setting the stage of the foundation for what later happened with cloud computing, which is you're going to have this virtualized infrastructure on-prem.
Yeah.
You know, essentially on your own service, right?
Was it forced on you or did you embrace it? I mean, I don't know that a lot of people ran willingly to cloud. It depended on the younger the company was, the more interested you were in moving to cloud, because you didn't have a lot of dedicated infrastructure on it. Like, startups were all over cloud.
Yeah, but these are not the traditional Microsoft houses, right? So,
no.
You know, in our communities.
No, the usual place I saw big companies get into cloud was, we're about to sign another 5 years with XYZ data center. Mm-hmm. Is this the right thing to do because it's a giant 2-comma number?
Yep.
Or do we try this cloud thing?
Yeah, this transition, they always use the term, you know, what's the low-hanging fruit,
right?
And in the beginning, we thought the low-hanging fruit was email. I think it might have actually been storage, you know, that kind of OneDrive, SharePoint type stuff.
Yeah, but it had more sovereignty issues.
Every one of these things has their issues. But,
yeah.
But you know, they SharePoint's fixed now, right?
by so, taking away a whole bunch of capability, yes.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, cloud computing, absolutely. I know. Yeah. Sorry. I don't know. But this last question, though, is the most fascinating to me, because
who's more impacted, devs or IT pros?
On a role basis. In other words, you said earlier in the show, and I think this is correct, that no one is really losing a job because of AI. You might be losing, if you break your job down into a set of whatever, 10 to 100 responsibilities, some of those are going to change.
They're automated. They don't take a lot of time anymore.
Yep.
Which is, you know, you think about what's happened to Exchange for most organizations, is like you're down to one or two people who part-time manage Exchange infrastructures.
Yep. And so I guess in that sense, it's hard because AI moves very quickly, but devs or IT pros, I think they have the same level of impact in some ways, right? Where it's almost like a granular, things will be automated for you. That's good. That will allow you to focus on the thing, you know, the proactive thing again, right? And devs and IT pros, I would say, you know, what are you going to do with your free time? It's an interesting question. So do you know?
So far I've seen the dev way more impacted because of only the developers have I seen certain folks embrace these tools and become wildly more productive. like
yes,
massive changes in the way that way it worked. It doesn't work for everybody. You know, the funny part is I just talked to somebody who's done one of these, I took a 6-week sprint and finished it in 4 days kind of things.
Right.
And I'm like, you must have loved that. He goes, no, it sucked.
Oh, interesting.
It took because now he's purely a project manager in some respect with strong technical skills. Like the thing that was the most fun about software development, that whole getting the code
the work.
Yeah. It's right. been automated in some respect. Well, he's just shepherding these bots to generate code.
Yep.
So he's mostly focused on requirements and testing infrastructure and like making sure that the bots are correct, generating good code. I just don't think IT role breaks down that way.
It might just be a timing issue though, right? I mean, I think one of the big benefits to AI, to developers for AI is it's a finite body of work or data to work off of. Mm-hmm. It's very much localized, this thing. So
testable, improvable.
You're a C# developer. You're doing a very specific type of app or service, whatever. It really cuts down on the extraneous information they're going to feed this thing. Windows Server, Azure, whatever. I know Microsoft is partitioning these things out to make them more accessible to AI. And it will get better over time. But I think it's just early, I think, for that a little bit. And I think it comes. Like, I think we're going to see the same benefits for IT Pro.
Yeah, I think they're going to be a different shape. I kind of look forward to, like, an email waiting for me each day from a piece of software that's gone over my tenant and all of my responsibilities in system in space and is helping me with a priority list that's more preventative than this is what's on fire today. You know, I think that's interesting.
I don't know. I'm like, when I get busy, every once in a while, I'll be like, oh, I gotta go look at my email. Mm-hmm. And when I do, it's always like, oh, no.
Why did I look here?
Like, oh, what is going on here? You know, like when I left it, there were no unread emails. And now and then it's hundreds. Like, okay. Then you triage, you go through it, and you're like, oh, now I gotta do, oh, no. You know, and like, that's how my days go. I can't say I've ever looked forward. Well, I guess I have, but I haven't looked forward to too many emails. Something that just pops up every once in a while and says, everything's great. You know, it's not too bad, I guess. Yeah. You know, the green checkbox or whatever.
Yeah. You know, again, that's that great email. It's like, here's what's working.
Yes.
Here's what's not working. Here's what could be better. And you can say, like, what's your mood? What do you want to tackle today? Do you feel preventative? Like, I can give you work in every one of those levels.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, different personalities, I guess. You know, it's like, do you want to hear the bad news first or the good news?
Yeah. Well, how do you want to come at that? But, you know, and really, that's a system in kind of world, like where you're sort of looking over the landscape going, what am I missing here? What haven't I noticed? And the one thing you never notice is stuff working well.
Yeah. Which is why I think AI will eventually have that same impact there, because it's more difficult for any human being to grok all of the inputs and you know, parts of an infrastructure, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
If you're a developer and you're a subject matter expert in whatever language, whatever framework, whatever, you're probably like locked in and you know exactly where to go when something goes wrong. And making sense of just the sheer mass of data that impacts an environment, I think is going
to. Well, and the workflows, where data is moving, where it isn't, where people are, like there's so much to look at. You were asking me about still using Grammarly the other day, and I realized one of the reasons I like Grammarly, they send me an email each week telling me how awesome I am.
Yes, that's right.
How many words you wrote, and here's how corrections were done. It's very complimentary.
It's always very complimentary. You're better than 98% of the
exactly.
people. Exactly. Like, I love this. Can I pay for this service? Oh, I can? Did. Thank you.
Yeah, I am paid
for it. Now you're better than 99% of it. You're like, nice. You know.
Oh, it's so true. So, I mean, the other thing I think is distinct about dev is there is kind of a finish line for a lot of code. Like, you get to a feature complete, you get to testable and so forth. And there is no finish line for any system in task. It's an infinite landscape. It's like asking, you know, is your house renovation done? What do you mean by done? There is no done. There's only, we can live here now.
Well, this was.
And what isn't on fire?
See, this was true when cloud computing was coming in, because I've referenced this a few times in the show, but the exchange guy, like, what are you doing? This is my job. You're killing my job.
Yeah.
The other half of the story is that in the other room are the developers, and it's like a conga line in there. And they're like, the cloud's coming. We get to rewrite all our code for a new platform. Yay. You know, like those guys are like, awesome. You know, the IT pro is like, oh, what are you doing to me? What, like, this is terrible. You know, it's a completely different look, you know, or outlook or whatever.
Yeah, it's challenging. All right, last question. And Mark Wansel back again. I'm not sending you 3,000 episodes. Spark. You get one. Just nice. One. Recently, we've had a pandemic, wildfires, devastating floods, and even more. How do you envision AI-enabled disaster response? With the current cost of AI, do you foresee a place for AI in open solutions like Humanitarian Toolbox, a charity that I'm a part of? What other AI-enabled applications can you envision? For example, dynamic evaluation of maps for floods, fire, or kinetic war activity? I mean, besides Skynet, how might AI hinder humanitarian aid? I know from working with a bunch of disaster response people that, I mean, they're already using drones
yes.
and software to automatically recognize different levels of damage, you know, states of things. So that's already a thing.
Yep.
And generative AI are part of those with inevitably. It's just to be able to get more information in faster. So the fact that they don't have to put people up in those airplanes, they are automated yep. and can fly perfect racetracks. And if you lose one, it's bad, but you didn't kill anybody.
Well, weather forecasting or hurricane, I guess forecasting,
yeah.
Has become a lot more accurate all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. You know, we've seen AI has translated ancient documents that no human was able to translate. It has helped doctors make diagnoses that they would not have made on their own.
Yeah,
that kind of thing. And I, you know, look, cynically, one of the sentences in this question is, how do you envision AI enabling disaster response? It's like, well, how do I envision it enabling disasters? You know, is the other half of this question, sure. right? Like, you know, so we have to get on top of that too. But, I think this is where AI is going to have a dramatic impact. All this stuff,
And already underway. It's just being able mm-hmm. to do more in less time, have more and information and better organized.
Yes.
I remember talking to a group of folks during Hurricane Sandy. And one of the problems they had was there were so many different organizations that were working in the field there that folks that were still on site, like their homes were sufficiently functional, that they were staying on there, were interviewed multiple times by different groups, all asking the same questions. What do you need? How can yes. we help you? Da, 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 da. Like the coordination became yep. really problematic. And the fact that we might have out information before, you know, anybody needs to knock on the door, much less just coordinate the data. Like there's lots of software to make that better.
Yep.
You know, one of the things that happened in that period when that was HDBox then too, was they went from like four organizations that respond to a disaster to hundreds.
Yes.
And so nobody was prepared to manage the fact that because of the internet, because of social media, all these little organizations raised enough money that suddenly they had teams showing up at disaster sites and trying to help.
Yeah.
All with good intention. I mean, you'd hope.
But also stumbling on top of each other and getting in the way.
Yeah. Overlapping incredibly. And it was very challenging for the so-called professionals yeah. to deal with that. I'm not going to leave off that last bit either, Mark, about how does AI mm-hmm. hinder humanitarian aid? Because we've already seen this too. AI are awesome tools for generating misinformation. And during a disaster,
right.
Misinformation gets a lot of clicks, for better or worse. We create perverse incentives. And it hurts people. I don't know. It's just an amplifier. I mean, interesting.
Yep.
We already had this problem when it was people doing it. What happens when it's software doing it? Like,
It's automated. Yeah. It saved us a lot of time. That's yeah. just, you know, the central promise there.
We're getting really quick at hurting people now, boy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's such a low cost.
We had I can't remember, recently on Windows Weekly, Leo had asked, there was an issue recently as we record this about SSDs going up, you know, failing after installing a Windows update.
And right.
I looked into this and I haven't written about it because I don't really see evidence that this yeah. is happening. I see the stories, but they all seem to be based on a single, like, you know, X Twitter tweet or a Reddit post somewhere, whatever.
Yeah.
And then it was interesting to watch the kind of ebb and flow. It's not, as we record this, it's not been completely resolved, but now Microsoft has come out and said this absolutely was not caused by a Windows update. And I think the company's name is Fizon, I think they make disk controllers for SSDs, hard drives, right. et cetera. They 4,500 hours spent testing all their stuff, and they said it's absolutely not the Windows update, and it's also not our controller software. And in both cases said, and by the way, we don't actually see any evidence of this happening at scale anywhere. So this is, you know, self-publishing is such a wonderful, you know, human right now. Yeah. Anyone can get their views out there. And now people write stories based on it, and then they spread because someone wrote a story, and then someone writes a story based on the story that's based on a story that's not a credible source. And all of a sudden, someone's asking me why I haven't written a story about something that it turns out is not a thing,
yeah.
you know, necessarily, or certainly not a thing that was caused by a Windows update, which was the original charge. And we just wasted a week on that. So fun.
Easy. And then suddenly, you know, I appreciate that we're starting to hesitate now. It's like, let's wait till the experts actually give us repeatable data.
Well, that's, yep. Oh, experts. That's an interesting term. I thought we had gotten by those people. So that's good. Yeah, we need to be asking questions like that, and we need to be checking for accuracy.
Yeah.
This all sounds like such obvious, basic advice, but
yeah,
there we are.
Yeah, it's true enough. Paul, that's over an hour.
Yeah.
So sorry for a real long show. Hope it was useful for you. Thanks so much for hanging with me, friend. That was good fun.
Oh, you bet. This was an honor. I'm very, very happy to have done this. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's great. And here we are. I don't know what the future holds. I'm still having a good time doing this.
Nice.
You know, the good news is, you'll notice this on the ads. These days, the ads are all conferences, and those are my conferences that are making.
Yeah.
So, you know, post pandemic, we've gotten a good conference groove. We're making enough money that I just stopped pursuing other advertising. It wasn't necessary. Mm-hmm. The show was paid for through that. And so that's going to keep going. It's not particularly painful. I have not changed the workflow very much. There are two people who helped me make this show. You hear one of them at the top of every show. His name is Brandon Nguyen, where he has edited every single Run As Radio episode.
Wow.
I'm grateful to him for that. Admittedly, I do pay him. And
that's great.
And my friend Beth Heath, who is the graphics person who makes the funky 8-bit headshots and all that sort of stuff. So she's working with me almost as long. So yeah, and that's how the show gets made. It's not more complicated than that. I pick the guests, I do the conversations, Brandon does the edit, Beth helps me with the look and stuff. And
let me, if you don't mind, I will say, I think a big part of it too, though, is you have access to such great people that you get on the show. And that is just incredible. So to me, this is a combination of you and your just subject matter expertise or whatever, but also just the connections you have and the ability to get the right people to come on. And it just makes the show so valuable.
I do have an epic Rolodex, right? Everybody takes my call.
Right. No, it's great. Because, you know, look, any person just talking about whatever topic is okay, fine. It could be good, bad, and different, whatever. But I think what really puts us over the top is the combination of you with whomever, you know, the expert. And then the occasional goon like me, but usually an actual expert.
An actual expert. Yeah, I was trying to explain it to somebody. It's like, look, I'm fairly knowledgeable. I've had opportunity to collect off a little information. But I don't make these things. I am a troubadour. Right. I tell stories about things, but the folks who make them are phenomenal. And occasionally I get complimented. It's like, hey, thanks for explaining my product to the world better than me.
Yeah.
Because I was way too busy making it.
This is the Reese's peanut butter cup of IT Pro Podcasts. You know, it's two great tastes that go together.
Yeah. We help each other. And thanks for all the folks who contributed questions. I hope we got to almost all of them. Mm-hmm. We did have to limit for time to some degree. We went a little long today. And we're certainly making that special 1,000 mug up for everyone. And we'll get some mailing addresses squared away and send them out. And thanks, buddy. Have a good trip. I know you're on your way out the door, but I'll see you on Wednesday when we make Windows Weekly together.
Presumably.
Maybe.
We'll see how it goes.
Listen,
probably.
It's not good. Windows Weekly would not be fun if you didn't show up, let me tell you. Like, I know you can do it without me, but I don't think I can do it without you.
I will say you've given me the confidence that if it has to happen, I feel good about it. You know, if I can't be there.
I could do something, but we'll figure it out.
You seem like you know your way around a microphone. I don't know.
It's
an opinion.
I'll work it out. Hey, thanks so much for listening to the special episode. And we'll talk to you next time on Run As Radio.